Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 232, Mindfulness and the Art of Choice, with Dr. Karen Sherman. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
By being mindful of how you're feeling in a situation and starting to be aware of that, because you can never make a change unless you're aware, but starting to first be aware of yourself, you can start to question it. You can start to observe it. And then you can start to make changes. And the change is never going to be a quick process, nor is it going to be overnight, nor is it going to be steady. But little by little, you can start to make those changes, and then you can actually have the ability to look something over and say, is this really what I want? And even if it doesn't go the way you want it to go, you can learn from it.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Karen Sherman, speaking about her book on mindfulness and the art of choice. Karen Sherman, PhD, a licensed psychologist in New York, has been in private practice for over 20 years. Her focus is relationships and marriage and helping people achieve their greatest potential. Karen is the author of Mindfulness and the Art of Choice, Transform Your Life, which enables people to let go of conditioned responses and empower them to make their own choices. She's also the co-author of Marriage Magic, Find It, Keep It, and Make It Last, as well as a contributor to 101 Great Ways to Improve Your Life, Volume 2, writing a chapter about overcoming stress. She's a featured writer on Yahoo Personals, a relationship blogger for thirdage.com, and writes the disputes column for hitchedmag.com. Karen also conducts workshops, teleseminars, and speaking engagements. She's a frequent guest on national radio, and her expert opinion has appeared in numerous publications. Additionally, she was a former relationship expert on the Beau Griffin Morning Show, and a marriage expert on clubmom.com. Karen also teaches in the undergraduate psychology program at CW Post University. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Karen Sherman, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Dave. I appreciate it.
I'm pleased to speak with you. And I'm hearing that it's very snowy. You're in New York, right?
I am indeed, and we are waiting for the blizzard to hit big time.
Yeah, Washington, D.C., the government is closed down. How far are you from New York City?
I'm in a suburb, and so without traffic, it would take about 35 minutes. That's not a usual occurrence, though, but we're supposed to be getting hit, you know, really, really big. So we've got all our food supplies, and we're all warm, and we're just cozying up and getting ready for, you know, what's going to hit.
I actually miss that. I've lived in the East at various points in my life, and it's kind of fun to get snowed in and just to kind of have to give up on everything for a while.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's called cocooning, I guess.
Yes. Yes. It's a lot of fun. And my daughter is visiting from Australia, and so it's like an extra play day I have with her. So it's wonderful.
That's great. Well, I've been reading your self-help book, Mindfulness and the Art of Choice, and it was the title of your book that really grabbed me because, in a way, that title really says it all.
Well, then I'm glad that I picked that title.
yeah, it's a great title. And we'll get into that in a little bit. But in the introduction and the early chapters, you tell the story of your own growing up. And I think that's always of interest to listeners. So maybe that's a good place for us to start here. Tell us about the sorts of challenges that you faced growing up.
Well, as you probably know, Dave, a lot of us who go into the field, not everyone, but a lot of us who go into the field of psychology have had a dysfunctional childhood. And mine, I feel, was especially dysfunctional. And for a very, very long time, I had this fantasy of having a relationship with my mother, because I really felt that through my childhood, I wasn't able to get close to her because of a very domineering and abusive father. And then what happened is, and I tell that story in the book, and I do so for a reason, which I am glad to explain. But what eventually happened was he died. I thought, oh, wow, now I finally have my mommy. And I purposely say mommy because it was really this childhood fantasy. And lo and behold, what I found out is that there was no emotional nurturing mommy. And since I had held on to this hope, this dream, this fantasy my entire life, it really threw me into a tailspin. Initially, if you looked at me from the outside, it looked like I had a very successful life. I was married. I have two children at the time. I had a thriving practice. But internally, there was a void. And so here I thought my void was going to be filled.
Yes.
And clearly, you know, not only was that void not filled, but it really opened up this huge wound for me. What then happened was that it set off a horrible, horrible depression. So painful at one point that I wasn't sure that I could stand the pain. And I had to make a choice. And that choice was whether I wanted to continue living or not. And so, obviously, I made the choice that I wanted to, and worked with somebody using tools to help me deal with the pain, and found them to be very successful, continued to use them with clients, and felt that the tools I was using was very different than traditional talk therapy. And therefore felt, wow, this is something that was so helpful to me and others that I really became very impassioned about wanting to share those tools with other people. And so that's really what was the motivation for writing the book.
Uh-huh. Now, how long ago was this crisis that you were describing?
I would say it was now about 20 years ago, 15, 20 years ago.
Okay. And, you know, as you say, often those of us in the helping professions are trying to work out some of our own issues and have the fantasy that, well, if we learn how to help others, we will somehow in that process get our own needs met. And I know when I was a student, I bridled at that notion when it was implied by some of my teachers. And I think at this point in my life, I can look back at my own life and realize that that was more true for myself than I was willing to admit at the time. Mm-hmm. Was there something that happened in your life 20 years ago that kind of triggered those childhood traumas to kind of create the crisis that you experienced?
Well, as I said, you know, when I finally had this clear pathway to my mother. And, you know, initially when my father died, it was, you know, 2-3 times a week. And, you know, I had all these expectations of now finally having this typical mother-daughter relationship. There was no mother. She just was not emotionally available. And so I had to reflect back on my entire childhood with a very different kind of reflection and realize that she truly was never available to me. And then sort of reassess all the pain that I had gone through, all the time she was absent, all the time she didn't protect me. And there were many, many things in my childhood which were very abusive, of various types of abuse, where she did not step in and help me and be nurturing and take care of me. And as I said, I had always made this excuse thinking, well, she couldn't because my father was such a villain. But, you know, after this situation presented itself to me, I realized it was not really because he was such a villain, which he was, but also because she was not able to be available and to step into that role. And it felt very lonely. It felt very for me. And so, you know, that feeling, that pain, that void, having it come up from my childhood was just, and I think very often what happens with people is that when they reach that level of devastation, it very often catapults them, it bolts them into really taking a very clear look at what their life is and having to face the reality of their life and then go from there, hopefully in a positive direction, which I truly feel. I mean, at this point, I look back, Dave, and I'm very happy that all that happened to me, which may sound kind of strange, but I'm really not at all upset that my childhood happened to me, that the incident that I'm describing to you happened to me, because I know that I wouldn't be who I am today had I not lived through all of those experiences.
Exactly. I totally understand that. I totally understand that. Well, tell us a little bit about how you came to be a psychologist, psychotherapist. What did you major in college? And then how did it evolve into this particular career?
You know, that's interesting because when people ask me what my specialty is, I say that I specialize in relationships. But I always then qualify and I say, relationships with others or with yourself, because I really feel those two things are very intertwined. And the truth of the matter is that I have been a relationship specialist since I'm 8 years old, because my parents had such a horrible marriage, and there were so many awful things going on, and among the irresponsible or dysfunctional things they did is that they allowed me really to get involved in it and to attempt to help them when I was 8 years old.
Yes.
So to me, I've just been doing this my whole life.
Right.
It was a no-brainer. I mean, of course I was going to be a psychologist. You know, I've had years of practice doing it already.
Yeah.
It was just getting the credits then to back me up.
So did you major in... The reason I'm asking about all of this is some percentage of my listeners are students or people who are contemplating a career in psychology, psychotherapy. So I'm just trying to understand a little bit about your path. So did you major in psychology as an undergraduate even?
Yes, I did. I majored in psychology all the way through. You know, a lot of times when I'm teaching, Dave, what I tell students is that I think we each have things that come naturally to us, and those are our strengths. And if you can parlay and do something that matches with those things that are your strengths, that's what you're going to be really happy in, because those are the things that come easily to you. And so, you know, as I said, I've been doing this all my life, and so it just made sense for me to go into this. It was truly not a difficult decision for me to make.
Mm-hmm. And then as you went on into your graduate work, did you get trained in a particular approach?
I started out, my master's was in a humanistic approach.
Okay.
Then I just went on and had more of a clinical background, and I guess that for me, the humanistic approach, which is very non-directive, was not really fitting my style. I tend to be a little bit more active and directive. So I've gotten trained in a number of different ways, not necessarily through my graduate program, but I've gotten trained in cognitive certification program, and I've taken courses on my own. I continue to learn. I think that in order to stay fresh in my field, I'm always taking extra courses and extra trainings, because I really feel that that's the best way to go. I mean, up to and including the fact that last year I took a workshop with Sue Johnson, who is very strong on doing couples work with attachment theory. So I don't think, and this is my personal view, that you can really stay fresh and new and really offer your clients the best information unless you're staying on top of your game and your field.
Yes, I totally agree. And the way that I do it is through these interviews. I learn so much talking to people such as yourself.
Yeah, sure. You know, I think when we're constantly talking with each other and exchanging ideas, that is certainly a process of learning.
Yes. Now, the idea of mindfulness seems to have really caught on in a big way. How did you come to be involved with mindfulness?
Well, I think that what I realized for myself is that part of what I did in order to deal with my life was I became an overachiever. I was given a lot of reinforcement growing up for what I was able to do. I was a high school student. I was the class president. I was the editor-in-chief of my yearbook. I had all sorts of activities. And I also got very involved in school activities because that would be something my parents would accept, and it kept me out of the house.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, I became a busy person, and that allowed me to not feel my pain so much.
Mm-hmm.
But when you do that, you miss a whole bunch of life. You miss the small things in life. You're not aware of appreciating nature. You're not aware of appreciating your children's fun times. And so, again, as a result of this transformation that I went through, I was able to really access what it meant to have joy in life, to not be running around all the time, to really embrace those little moments and to stop and pay attention not only to my own signals so that I could be aware when something was upsetting me, but to really be cognizant of the things in life that were important and that were to be a priority. And I think that that's a major difference in how I live my life now as opposed to how I used to live it, which was just to get caught up all the time in this overdrive.
So then what would you say mindfulness means to you? I guess in a way you've just described it, but would you like to say anything more about what you mean when you use the word mindfulness?
I think it's a matter of being more present, being more in the now, not getting... not being in this autopilot, not being responding to things just habitually without actually being aware of what you're doing, which is what I think happens to people emotionally. I think that so much of our behavior is reactive, that those reactions are based on old patterns that we've learned in childhood. And so what I want to let people know is that they can bring this sense of awareness of themselves and how they're behaving to their everyday living so that they can then make choices, that they're not just repeating these old patterns and that they can truly live in the now, responding even to emotional situations with a choice.
Mm-hmm. I love the way in the book's title you pair mindfulness with what you call the art of choice.
Right.
And so what do you see as the relationship between these two, between mindfulness and choice? And you call it the art of choice.
Yes. I chose art because I see it as a process. I see it as something different than science. Science is something that's more precise. It's more exact. And in the book, I don't give people a formula because it's impossible. Everybody's got their own process, their own journey. But I do think that there's a methodology that can be offered as to how you can go about your journey. And so that's why I say it's the art of choice. It's the art. It's the process of learning how you can become more present, more aware of who you are, of how you're reacting, of what your behavior is really signifying about who you are. And once you start to become aware, you then have the choice to make changes and to control the way that you react to things, because that's really the only thing any of us have control over is our reactions. Because again, my feeling is that most of us just function on this autopilot.
What came to mind is Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. Mm-hmm. And he, in there, he talks about how when he was in a Nazi concentration camp,
right,
how exercising choice in a situation in which from the outside it looked like there was no choice, but just making small choices like hoarding a little bar of soap made mm-hmm. the difference between life and death.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because when you feel that you have some control over a situation, then there's all sorts of research which indicates that that will make you feel like you can go on living. But again, the point is that, you know, so many people will continue to function in situations where they're not getting the results they want and they're unhappy, and yet they continue to do it. Why? Because they just always do it that way. That's what they know. That's what they're comfortable doing.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't have to be that way. So again, by being mindful of how you're feeling in a situation and starting to be aware of that, because you can never make a change unless you're aware, but starting to first be aware of yourself, you can start to question it. You can start to observe it. And then you can start to make changes. And the change is never going to be a quick process, nor is it going to be overnight, nor is it going to be steady. But little by little, you can start to make those changes, and then you can actually have the ability to look something over and say, is this really what I want? And even if it doesn't go the way you want it to go, you can learn from it. But again, you're clearer thinking. You're not just caught up in, let's say, like that feeling of drowning because a wave is coming at you. You know that, you know, if you can imagine a wave coming at you and you're under the water and you can't really see clearly and you're just sort of like desperately trying to stay afloat, you have the ability to really sort of deal with the situation and make a choice as to how you want to respond to it.
As you point out, though, we tend to respond automatically, and that can happen mm-hmm. just so quickly. How does a person become sufficiently mindful to move from being on automatic to being more choiceful?
Well, first of all, I want to comment on, you know, your astute comment that you're right. It is in a nanosecond that we respond, and that's based on the fact that we've got these wired in implicit memories, or as we would say, you know, in normal jargon, that our buttons are getting pushed.
Yes.
So the first thing is that you've got to observe yourself. So if the way I notice it with clients and the way people can start to notice it in themselves is if they see that their reactions are these intense reactions that happen so quickly and they can't seem to let it go. And sometimes I tease people where I say to them, you know, if you swear with every cell in your body that it's the other person, chances are it's really because it's you.
Mm-hmm.
So when you start to see that, then there's a way that you can start to really allow yourself to be aware of your body. Your body is your barometer. There's always going to be a bodily reaction, a bodily sensation when you're feeling something emotional. And so if you start to tune in to that and become aware of your body, then you can say, okay, so what is it that I'm really feeling? What did this situation that just upset me, what did that remind me of? And when you start to look at that, you can actually, what I would call, float back and go back and think about, okay, you know, when I was 10, there was something that felt the same to me. And that's the process I'm talking about, Dave, that then you get to really what the root is, that whatever just happened now between you and me, yeah, that really upset me. That set me off. But it's really not what just happened now. It's not what you just said to me. It's because it reminded me of something else. And when you get to the root, then you can start doing the healing work where you can start to change these wired-in neural connections. Because if you don't get to those roots, it's almost like you're working with weeds. You keep cutting the weeds down, and momentarily your lawn looks good, but they're going to grow back. So if you don't deal with the original source of injury, they're going to keep getting triggered every time there's a situation that reminds you of the original wound.
Okay. Well, this kind of ties into another thing that you write about, which is releasing fear. How big an issue is fear in your experience of working with people?
Oh, major. And, you know, I would say that the two strongest emotions are love and fear. And if you're working from a fear perspective, one can become unbelievably paralyzed. But that fear is fear, most likely, that you have wired in again from your childhood. And so when something happens in the now, and it triggers the fear from your childhood, you're no longer responding as an adult. You're responding to the remembered fear of your childhood. So, as an example, I'm working with a client who has the fear that he's not going to succeed at something. It paralyzes him horribly in trying to get a job. And so he really, you know, can't send out resumes, and he can't, you know, go for job interviews. It has nothing to do with the reality of who he is, because when he actually does certain things, he's quite successful. So the point is that you've stored these memories, but you've stored them as a child. So have you ever had the experience where you've had the opportunity to go back and see a kindergarten classroom, and you look at it and you say, oh my God, look how small those chairs are?
Yes, I've sat right? in those chairs as a parent.
That's right. But when we were little, those chairs didn't look small to us.
No.
Well, the same thing happens with these fears or these pains that we've had, you know, from childhood. We've stored them as children. So when we go back to it, when they come up for us, we feel them as if we are the child. Well, we have to tell ourselves that. Yes, they feel awful. So what happens is, as soon as the fear comes up, we shy away from it. Oh, no, I don't want to feel that. I don't want to feel that. Well, the truth of the matter is, if you would allow yourself to re-experience it, it's only going to hurt for a little while. And if you start to work with it, and I do that through visualizations, if you start to work with that and allow those feelings to come out, then they go away.
Yeah, well, for example, the fellow that you were talking about who was having trouble going out looking for a job, how did you use visualization, if in fact you did, working with him?
Okay, there's two things. One thing is to go back to some of the early sources where he had experiences where he didn't succeed, and for him to work with the image of his small self and allow his small self to be able to express whatever the negative experiences were. And he does that, again, visually expressing them to his adult self as he is now.
Mm-hmm.
The adult self is supposed to substitute in for the nurturing, loving, unconditional parent that we would all love to have.
Yes.
Okay? And by the expression, but again, this is done with energy work. In other words, with a bodily feeling coming up, not just talking about it cognitively. Mm-hmm. And through that process of the adult self being understanding and loving and healing, eventually the small self feels, okay, it's okay. I don't feel so bad about it. I mean, I'm simplifying it. So that's one way. The other way is that as the fear comes up, to acknowledge the fear, not to say don't be ridiculous or don't be silly or put yourself down because you got enough of that when you were a kid, but to acknowledge it and say, but you know what? I need you, little one, to trust me, to allow me to do this, and to start to take little steps. Because when you start to take little steps and they're successful, the small self will start to say, okay, this is working out. And then you take the next step. And when the little self gets scared again, you can say, when you trusted me and you allowed me to take that step, it worked out. And little by little, the confidence starts to build. Again, you know, in an interview such as this, I'm oversimplifying it. But the main point is to be able to transform the experiences that were stored in early childhood, but to do more than just talk about it, to actually bring up the raw feelings from childhood so that they can be worked with visually, because through the visualizations, they start to get transformed. There's lots of literature about the effectiveness of visualizations.
Yes, yes, and certainly what you're saying makes a lot of sense, even though, as you say, you're needing to simplify for interview purposes. It certainly is clear, and it makes sense to me. I love the kindergarten metaphor of the little chairs, by the way. Mm-hmm. I hope I remember that. I don't have a lot of confidence that I will, but it's lovely.
No, I think you will. I have confidence in you.
Oh, good. I'm feeling better already. Now, you've got a chapter on being with others, and we are social animals. And at the same time, it seems that many of our biggest challenges lie in relationships. What have you learned about that?
Oh, there's so much I could say about that. And let me just say that the newest edition of my book is coming out in a couple of weeks, because I've added a chapter on how to actually use these tools when you are involved in a relationship. So there's a lot that I have to say about it. The first thing that I want to tell people is that, unfortunately, our media has really romanticized the concept of being in a relationship, and they've made it out as if you must be in a relationship, because if you're not in a relationship, you're not complete. And that's hogwash. Is it nice to be in a relationship? Absolutely. There is, you know, a la Sue Johnson that I mentioned before, work which indicates that as human beings, we all need a sense of healthy attachment. However, as I said a moment ago, media has made it sound like we can't live without each other. Mm-hmm. You know, you complete me. You had me at hello. And that's just not true. So when you put yourself in that position, if you lose somebody, either through a breakup or through divorce or through death, God forbid, then you feel like you don't exist anymore. And that's just not healthy. So that's why I wanted people to know that it really was okay to be without a partner. Because in being in relationship with yourself, it's very important to accept yourself for who you are, that you are complete with yourself. You're not going to be perfect. You have to accept yourself, warts and all, because there are some parts of you that are not perfect, and there are many parts of you that are very special. And the more that you can accept yourself for who you are, the more that you're going to give out that vibe, and then guess what? You're probably going to be more desirable as a partner. But once you entrust your happiness to somebody else, you're going down a very slippery slope.
Yes. In fact, I see that you co-authored an earlier book on marriage called Marriage Magic, Find It, Keep It, and Make It Last.
Yes.
Yeah. How does one create a magical marriage?
Well, I think that what happens is, you know, the divorce rate, as we all know, is very high. And what I was finding is, so I was seeing all these couples who were staying married, but they were really unhappy. And they were unhappy because their marriages were getting stale. And so that book was written because I wanted to help people learn how to revitalize their marriages. And so many people complain, oh, the best part of the marriage is the honeymoon phase. And, you know, what happened to that? Well, you know what? You can have that back. What's unique about the honeymoon phase is that you prioritize your relationship. You let the other person know that they matter. Now, in reality, of course, once you get married and you start to feel comfortable with each other, there's a bit of a trade-off. You know, you've got the commitment, you feel more comfortable, and life happens. And for many couples, part of life is also that you have children. Now, of course, even though it says marriage magic, it's also any couple that's in a long-term committed relationship. So this doesn't apply just to marriage, and nor does what I'm saying about what happens to a long-term relationship. But if you want those feelings back, prioritize your relationship. Let each other know that you matter to each other. Do little things to let each other know that you appreciate each other, that you respect one another. And so those are the things that are going to help you have a solid, good relationship.
Yeah, and you're saying this as someone who's been married for some time, right?
Yes, I'm about to be married 35 years this summer to the same man.
Okay, good for you.
And I think it's also important to have the proper expectations of what marriage is about. You know, it's really not about getting carried off on a white horse and living happily ever after. There are times, you know, it's so interesting. I had somebody come into me about a year ago, and she was very upset because she was not feeling in love with her husband. And I said, you know, the first time that happened to me in my marriage, I got really scared. She said, the first time? I said, oh, yeah. You feel, you know, like, you know, oh, my God, something terrible is happening. And then you fall back in love again. And then the next time it happens, you're not as nervous. She said, wow, nobody ever tells you that. Well, sure. You know, a relationship is a live kind of phenomena. It ebbs and it flows. So there's going to be good times and there's going to be not such good times. And I think that, unfortunately, there's not enough information that couples have about what to expect in a relationship.
Wow, that really makes sense to me because, as you point out, there is so much romanticization mm-hmm. in the media. I mean, just listen to, you know, pop music, for example, is mm-hmm. almost exclusively about that sort of early stage of infatuation.
Right. Right. But, you know, what are those songs? Who writes those songs? And who writes those novels? Those are really the projections, if we can use a psychological term, of the artists. So those are their dreams and those fantasies.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But not reality. Not reality.
Yeah. Well, speaking of media, I see that you're very much a media psychologist, writing for Yahoo Personals, a relationship blog for thirdage.com, a disputes column for hitchedmag.com and clubmom.com, and also a frequent guest on NPR. How have you managed to, again, I'm thinking of listeners maybe who, you know, are trying to think about their own careers. How have you managed to build this aspect of your career?
Well, little by little.
Okay.
Okay.
You're very persistent. I learned that about you.
Yes,
because you didn't let go of me.
I know. I am persistent. In high school, I will share with you that they voted me most stubborn. And when the advisor was giving me the award, he said, we'll really say she's most persistent. I am persistent. I do it little by little. And I don't necessarily do all of it. For instance, Club Mom now is not using experts as much. I try to create balance. So I regularly blog for thirdage.com. I write for Hitched Mag irregularly. None of what I've put in my bio is an untruth, but I wouldn't say that I do all of it every week.
Right.
Because it's just impossible to do all of it every week. But I make sure that I keep my sort of toes in a whole bunch of different places.
Okay. So there's still a little bit of that overachiever in there, huh?
Yeah. And, you know, I have to tell you, I try to just sort of say, I'm not going to do it. And I guess it's just who I am as a person also. If I cut it out totally, I'm just not happy as a person.
I think I'm similar, so I can definitely understand that. Now, I believe you also teach at the university level. Is that right?
I do. I teach undergraduate psychology, and I have my private practice.
Yeah. What courses do you teach?
I teach, this semester, I'm teaching the second half of introductory psychology as well as social psychology.
Okay. Well, as we wind down, is there anything else that you'd like to say? Maybe something that you had hoped to get in that you didn't get a chance to say?
Yes. In a self-serving manner, I'd like people to know that they can get my book either at my website, which is drkarensherman.com, or at any of the online bookstores. But more importantly, I want people to know that part of the reason that I was as revealing as I was in the book is because I have truly lived this situation. I don't want people to think that I just espoused what I did to tell them what they should do. I have been there. I have known the pain. And I am very passionate about getting this message out. You do not have to be a prisoner to your past. Things can be different. I know it feels scary many times to feel the pain, but it does go away. And there is no reason that anybody should not have a joyous life. And I am really, in my own little way, on a mission to let people know that. And so that's why, Dave, I was so persistent in trying to get onto your show, because you are affording me the opportunity to get that message out. And I'm so appreciative of that.
Well, it's a great message. Dr. Karen Sherman, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
And I thank you again.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. Karen Sherman. You heard me make reference to her persistence. The story behind that is I had possession of her book for quite a long time. I had a whole stack of books to go through and other guests that I'd lined up. Karen periodically sent me emails over a period of several months. Finally, I had a last-minute interview cancellation by another guest I had lined up, and due to Karen's persistence, I immediately thought of her, and she was willing to do the interview on short notice. I'm glad she was as persistent as she was, because she made some great points in the interview and closed with a wonderful message, I thought. There was a place in the interview where she spoke about the importance of learning to listen to your body as a way of knowing what's going on with yourself emotionally. That triggered a set of memories for me relating to when I first learned that lesson for myself. It was back in the days when I was in graduate school and was very involved in the encounter group movement. It was in the context of those marathon encounter groups that I learned to check into my body. Were my hands clenched? Was I holding my breath? Was there a knot in my stomach? I learned that these were important cues that I was reacting emotionally to what was going on in the group, and that instead of sitting on my feelings, as was my tendency, I needed to speak up. That was an important lesson for me then, and one that serves me well still. Dr. Sherman's book is a slim volume of 96 pages or so, which is a quick and easy read. Her style is simple and engaging, and she suggests an array of exercises to help you implement the ideas into your life. Her website, again, is www.drkarensherman.com, and Dr. is just abbreviated DR, so it's drkarensherman.com. She offers a free newsletter there as well as a free mini e-course on how to have a great relationship. I encourage you to check it out.
I've been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long, just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet and he plays it so warm. Shrink wrap radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking shrink wrap radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
Hello, everyone out there. It's a beautiful spring-like day here in Northern California as I record this. I have some good news to report. I've long felt that these interviews should somehow be able to earn CEUs, that's continuing education units, for those seeking licensure or licensure renewal or certificates in certain areas. Well, I'm teaming up with the Zur Institute, an online provider of continuing education credits for a variety of helping professions. I'll be pulling together clusters of interviews to form creditable courses around topical areas such as dreams, positive psychology, and so on. It will take a while to put these courses together, but I'm very excited about this latest development. I'll keep you posted as this initiative moves along. My plans for Prague and Vienna in May are pretty well solidified, but I have a lot of work still to do on the presentation I'll be giving in Prague. Right now, it's too long, and I have to pare it down to its essentials, and I have to make it more dramatic somehow. However, I've heard from two listeners in the Vienna area, and I'm looking forward to a couple of face-to-face meetings with them. If you haven't done so already, you might want to hear my latest interview at wisecounselpodcast.com. It's with Dr. Kirk Schneider on existential humanistic psychotherapy. I first knew Kirk when he was a young intern, and he's gone on to become one of the leading exponents of existential humanistic psychotherapy and has published over 100 articles and chapters and has authored or edited 8 books. By the way, there is now a transcript on the Shrinkwrap Radio site of my interview with brain/meditation researcher Dr. Sarah Lazar. The transcript is a very quick way to take in the information or to refresh your memory. I find them very valuable and will be relying on them to formulate my CEU exam questions for those aforementioned CEU courses. And speaking of transcripts, we could definitely use more volunteer transcribers. Please drop me a line if you're interested. It's a great way for you as a transcriber to incorporate the material deeply during the transcription process. And let me remind you to check out our Shrinkwrap Radio store, where you'll find my CD with the 2 lectures I recently gave on positive psychology and the quest for happiness. I put both lectures on a single CD to give you greater value for your money. In addition, this CD includes the handout that I passed out to the group with the recommended readings and recommended Shrinkwrap Radio episodes related to positive psychology. And beyond that, you also get my PowerPoint presentation so that you'll be able to follow along, just as if you were there. You get both lectures for just $15 plus shipping, and your CD comes in a beautiful DVD-style case, which will fit nicely on your bookshelf. Finally, let me remind you that this show is supported by your generous donations, both those that are one-time and those that are continuing for 6 or 12 months. Thanks for your support.
Hi, this is corporate trainer and coach Tom Carroll, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Tom Carroll. You'll be hearing more from this longtime listener and corporate consultant in our next episode. In the meantime, let's dip into our listener mailbag. The first one is from Julia, who writes, "Dear Dave, I just listened to your interview with Pat Bracken, that's on Wise Counsel, and wanted to let you know right away how interesting and meaningful it was for me. I'm so glad to have his work and thinking brought to my attention as it fits right in with my layperson's general sense of the role and context of mental health, both its labeling and the treatment. One thought that came to me while listening is the parallel with the discussion in medical treatment of infection, the old argument about whether it's the bug or the soil. I don't think I'm quite remembering the exact phrase, but I think you'll know what I mean. So much of Western mental health theory approaches mental illness as if there was some invading organism or malfunction within the individual, almost completely out of context of their life. What Dr. Bracken seems to be saying is that the social/economic/cultural environment they live in is as much both the cause and the vehicle for healing as anything inherent in the individual. I'm not sure this is quite clear, as it's probably easier to explain verbally, but I did want to share the thought. I will add that I have my own example of the healing power of finding meaning in suffering. Many years ago now, in my recovery from having been bulimic, I still do not really like to use an external label to express my struggle, but it's an acceptable shorthand in some cases. A turning point involved exactly that, finding meaning in my suffering, not the bulimic behavior, but what I was feeling that was being expressed in a distorted way through that behavior. So thank you again for your work. I've been exploring some other psychology podcasts, and I think yours is really the best so far. You seem to have a broad scope and very intelligent listening and conversation with your guests, not to mention your choice of guests. I'll end by mentioning that one suggestion for an interview that I had made previously, Bob Fancher, is right up this alley as well and might be a worthwhile complement to the theme of substantive rather than wacky out there questioning of mainstream mental health care. Take care, Julia. Well, Julia, thank you so much for those comments. And by the way, I have interviewed Bob Fancher due to your suggestion. I've interviewed him on Wise Counsel, but I don't think that show has come up quite yet in the rotation, but keep checking. Next, we hear from Michael in Iraq. Hello, Dr. Dave. My name is Michael, and I'm currently serving in the Army overseas in Iraq. I stumbled on your show right around Christmas Eve when I was traveling through Kuwait. I very much enjoy it. I was very close to an associate's degree in computer information systems, software support, but a deployment got in my way a bit. I took one psychology class and very much enjoyed it, so I'm always trying to learn a little more. Good for you. I also was involved in a behavioral psychology class that I was absolutely fascinated with and took a lot of helpful information from. I've listened to quite a bit of your podcasts and started to keep a dream log in which I learned that I sure dream more often than I thought I did. Last night I had 3 dreams, and in the 3rd one, there were a bunch of horses running through an urban Oregon community, and according to the radio, Dr. Dave had just some kind of entrepreneurial endeavor where he made an agreement with the city to use the city as a range for his horses at night. I'm not sure what that means, but perhaps it meant I needed to make a small donation at your site. I think you got it. I think that was the meaning of it. He goes on to say, I'm currently catching up on your episodes, but was wondering about a video game addiction, specifically massively multiplayer online role-playing games, MMORPGs. I played 1 or 2 years and finally quit, and it felt like some people describing a bad relationship. I simply didn't understand how miserable it was making me until I gave it up. I even harbor ill will towards the company that made the game. I accept personal responsibility for my actions, but I feel the company was slightly to blame. In a sense, I feel they were my crack dealers, and the crack was getting more expensive as time went on. So far on your show, I really only heard of these games described in a positive manner. I was curious to know if there's been any information or surveys in the psychology world, or if you've had any guests that are familiar with people becoming addicted to these kinds of games. I have experienced many friends and family who call into work or don't sleep because of this. Thank you for the show, and keep up the good work, Michael. Michael, that is a great suggestion for a future interview. I've had a couple that have sort of touched on this topic, but not one that was square on dealing with the subject of video game addiction, and I have a good guest in mind for that. And so I very much appreciate hearing from you off in far-off Iraq, and I hope that you are safe and will continue to be safe. Michael, one more thought before I move on. I recently read a fascinating article in Wired magazine about addiction to these MMORPG-type games in China. They have special rehabilitation camps for young people there. The government's really concerned about it. And these camps sounded like they might be somewhere between a military boot camp and a concentration camp. In the article, one of the young gamers who was sent to such a camp was killed there. I sent an email to the article's author wanting to interview him, but unfortunately, he's never responded to me. And we'll close with one more email from another listener with a dream. This one is from Christina, who writes, Hi, Dr. Dave. I love listening to your show. Even when I think a topic might not be that interesting, I always come away fascinated and intrigued. There are some awful podcasts out there, but Shrink Wrap is always professional and has great, knowledgeable guests and a fantastic wide choice of topics. Thanks so much for that, Christina. That's what I strive to do. She goes on to say, as you're doing a lot on dreams and their significance for the dreamer's life, I just wanted to share with you a truly life-changing dream I had, a, quotes, big dream, as you call them. Basically, in that dream, I saw myself organizing my own funeral in Venice, Italy, of all places. I remember getting some things out of the way fairly swiftly, such as how many pallbearers, for example, and then deliberating endlessly on the music that was to, quote, see me off. In the end, I settled for Beethoven's Ode to Joy, but I remember getting very worked up in the dream as I couldn't remember the title of it, just the melody. All the time during this dream, I was fully associated in myself, but then it all happened. In my dream, I suddenly stood in front of myself, the self that was writing down the instructions, looking at my tear-streaked face, mascara everywhere, and suddenly, in that dream, I remember myself thinking about my crying other standing in front of myself, quotes, my God, I never appreciated how wonderful you were and how hard you strove to please me, end quote. Dream over. Needless to say, I woke up shaking and upset. Even now it still upsets me. Well, my interpretation, I'd say my critical parent self encountered my child self. I'd always been fairly perfectionistic, and other people sometimes commented that I'm a bit harsh on myself, but had no idea it was that bad. The dream left me shaken for about 3 days afterwards. I'm now on the journey of building a more positive self-image. I'm still not sure what the issue with the song was. It was definitely a big part of the dream as I got really worked up about it. The fact that my funeral was to be in Venice, I'm actually living in the UK, doesn't feel that significant. I think I watched a film about Venice slowly sinking a few days before, so that might have just been a bit of frill on the dream. Aren't dreams amazing? Keep up the great work. Kind regards, Christina. Christina, I think it's really wonderful that you were able to hear the message that this dream seemed to be shouting at you to back off of being so self-critical. And while the funeral imagery might seem frightening, it certainly was a dramatic way of getting your attention on the one hand, and on the other, I think might be foreshadowing the death of that overly self-critical part of yourself, making room for the birth of a more self-accepting part. So with that, I think it'll wrap it up for today. Remember to send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. In addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to my guest, Dr. Karen Sherman, for her insights on the role of choice in mindfulness. As I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with Tom Carroll, corporate coach and trainer. He's also a Shrink Wrap Radio listener and a really neat guy. I think you'll enjoy him quite a bit. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying it's all in your mind.